So the burning question, the absolute burning question is which or what breaking news are we going to miss this week?
We're going to miss because there's too much breaking news.
Well, 2 weeks ago, we record the pod. We're like, oh, that was a lot of fun. Lovely to speak to you. Off we rush. What was it? Half an hour later, Andy Murray reunites with Evan Lender. We're like, oh, for heaven's sake. We're like, fine, we'll wait till next week. Then last week, we do the pod. We talk about Andy Murray and Evan Lender. We're like, this is brilliant. Get to the end. See you later. Off we go. What happens? What? How many minutes later did the news happen that Ash Barty was quitting tennis? I mean, so that's the first question. Who does what after we finish recording this week?
Yeah, I know.
Go on, just go for something. Pick something. Ooh. Who's going to retire? Who's going to be fine?
Retire, because we had that last week with Ash. We managed to squeeze in Kyrgios's antics. He nearly got defaulted last night. I don't know if that's news, to be honest. I don't know. It's tough to tell.
As we say,
it?
Look, we're not a news or a breaking news pod. But
that's a good thing.
We've missed two fairly big stories in the last couple of weeks because, as we've said with tennis, there's always. I've got to say, since I think the start of the year in Djokovic and everything that happened with visas and non-visas and being kicked out of Australia, so many people I know have come up to me and wanted to talk more about tennis. And they've said things like, I never knew it could be so exciting. I never knew so much happened in tennis. Because it just feels like every day, every week, there is something happening that is newsworthy in the sport of tennis.
It's got an amazing, I said this not long ago, and a remarkable ability to reach the front pages of papers. And whilst Ash's retirement probably didn't reach the front page of the UK newspapers, it would have down under. There's just always something coming at us. And as well as the tournaments going on, and of course got big events on at the moment, we're in the midst of Miami. How on a scale of 1 to 10, how shocked were you? I mean, we weren't surprised that we missed the news and that it came out right after we recorded but before we put out the pod, but how surprised were you at that Ash has retired?
You know, the funny thing is, in the pod last week we were talking about when is the best time to retire. I thought that was the great thing, that we actually had a big section and largely centered around Serena Williams. It's like we knew something was going to happen, but we didn't know this. In terms of how shocked I was, it was weird. When I was in Australia at the start of the year, a couple of people said to me they'd heard rumblings that Barty was going to retire. And these were former players who said she wants to start a family, she wants to settle down. So I think in terms of Ash Barty retiring from tennis, I wasn't that shocked. In terms of the timing, I was pretty shocked. And I don't want to bring this back to money and what you can get, but she is at the peak of her powers, both on and off court. World number one, Australian Open champion. I know it's not all about being at the peak of your powers and what you can get from being at the top of your game, but I think for me, the timing, although people will then say, well, it's the mic drop, isn't it? You go out at the top of your game and you say, see you later. So surprised that she's retired young, no. Surprised at the timing, yes.
Yeah, I think, to be honest, a lot of people were in agreement with what you're saying there. I definitely was. As in, I thought, you know, she wasn't ever in it for a long time. Look, she already quit once. She clearly has struggles that she needs to manage, and that is tiring. And, yeah, we've always known she's such a home bird. Tennis is not based in one country, far from it. I think, we knew she's engaged and that is the next stage of her life. So, yeah, I think, again, I wasn't. So if you would have said to me, Ash has retired early as she's at the very top of the game, I would have been like, yeah, sure. Like, I think we all pretty much expected that. But possibly would have assumed that she would have, I would have expected her to have played like another year or two, maybe two is pushing it, but at least another year until she was married and, you know, that sort of thing was sorted and had settled down a little bit. Maybe she wasn't at the top of the game. Maybe she wasn't number one, but she was number three or number four. I don't know. But I mean, it felt like, you know, she's been able to select her tournaments and not play for long blocks of time. And that has helped her because the travel is so intense. And it felt like, oh, she's found a good balance here. And she also has the ability to be able to come back and then just be at the top of the sport. you know, like she did with Australia. She was just the best player, and she hadn't played for a long time coming into the Australian swing. So she had that sort of Serena Williams quality about her that Serena's always been able to do. And thought, oh, okay, so she can actually really limit the amount of tournaments she plays and still rack up a bunch of slams. So I just sort of expected her to do that for a year or two. But yeah, I didn't expect her to retire now. But you know, good for her. Great. I mean, what a career. I mean, amazing if you can wrap it all into that sort of time frame.
Oh, it's amazing. She's the only active player together with Serena Williams who's won slams on the three different surfaces. And she's done it, it feels, in sort of double quick time. I know this is through a pandemic. I didn't realise she said to her coach, Craig Tizer, after she won the French, can I retire now? So, it's. I mean, again, you reach the peak in terms of winning a Grand Slam. I mean, she said for her the dream was Wimbledon. It was winning Wimbledon. A lot of people thought it was kind of a game changer for her when she became Wimbledon champion. And therefore, it's like the icing on the cake is to win in Australia. And what better place to go out than in Australia, being Australian Open champion? I mean, it's she's always done things on her own terms. You touched on it. When she stepped away from the sport, she goes into another sport. She gets to pretty much the top of that sport. And then she missed tennis and she came back in to tennis. So, look, we're losing more than she's losing. We're losing seeing Barty play. We, in the world of tennis, we're the big losers here, right? She's done some incredible things. She's achieved so much. I think she's only 25 years of age. So it feels a bit selfish, doesn't it? Because we're the ones missing out because we're not going to see Barty play anymore.
Yeah, and it was so great, wasn't it, having her at the top. And with her game style, it was pretty different. And, it's gutting for us, isn't it? Because I think she's such a fan favourite. And for us tennis nerds, you know, we just love picking apart her game. And I remember it wasn't that long ago, probably on the Aussie Open recap, where I was saying that nobody's worked her out tactically.
Yeah,
I haven't seen anybody actually figure out her game, even if they don't win. Because sometimes you see players, for example, Maxime Cressy against Daniil Medvedev in Australian Open, Cressy served volleying. He'd actually worked out Medvedev's game because Medvedev just could not return that deep. It was, you know, it was the right tactic, but also you have to be able to deliver it point after point after point. He was doing it on first serves and second serves. You know, no other players do that. So he lost in four, but it was absolutely like, well, that is one way. There are other ways, but not loads. But that is a way to pick apart the game of Daniil Medvedev. Then had to change his game, come up to the baseline, and then he finally won. But it took him hours to do it because he was so stubborn. When you could see, even in the first set, when Medvedev won the first set, it weren't working. There's no success there at all. So it doesn't necessarily mean that you beat the person, but it's just about being able to find a vulnerability, expose that something that's working, something that rattles them. And, you know, very often you can see some of the lower ranked players doing that, like a Maxime Cressy, and then the top players go, oh, hang on. Right, I'm going to give that a go. Not that we've seen anyone really serve volley against Daniil very much, but again, it's just not part of their game. So something like that. And I just don't think we've ever seen anyone able to do it. Yeah, sure, people beat her. But in terms of tactically, she had it all sewn up. The perfect game style.
Do you see her? I can see her. I can see there being an involvement in tennis in some way in years to come. But do you see her actually coming back and playing again? Because a number of times players have stepped away and then they have returned. Do you see Barty coming back and playing professionally? I do believe we'll see her in tennis in some form, some way, somehow. I mean, she's still got so much to give to the sport and she still loves the sport, but she just doesn't want to do the travelling. She doesn't want to be doing, you know, the grind. She doesn't want to be away from home. Do you see her changing her mind on this and in a few years coming back?
Like a Kim Clijsters?
Yeah.
I don't. Because Kim retired a little bit earlier, didn't she? A little bit younger. Not much. I think she was 24, I believe, Kim Clijsters, when she retired the first time around, 23, 24. And it was to have a family. That was the point. And she'd always said, you know, I'm not doing this till I'm 30. You guys are crazy. But we are... still sort of waiting. She's played some exhibition matches, but we're still waiting for this third comeback, which is supposed to be happening. It's been delayed a lot, combination of COVID and other bits and pieces, injuries, whatever. Do I see her doing that? No, I don't. I don't see that. But then we were all mightily surprised when Kim came back. And Kim came back in a ridiculous match. How many tournaments did she win before winning a slam? Like, or play? I think like two or something. It was absolutely ridiculous. And when she won the US Open, it was mega. It was a game changer in terms of being a mum on tour, because to have a mum winning a slam was quite an extraordinary situation. But yeah, I think did she ever plan to come back after having kids? I don't think so. It felt quite final when she went, but maybe that door was always open. Doesn't feel very open with Ash, does it? But you never know. There's plenty of time.
I think because she's always been so firm, and she's always done. So during the pandemic, I know the borders were closed, so she couldn't train with her coach, Craig Tizer, but she made the decision, I'm just not traveling. And you could travel, but she said, I'm not going to. You know, for many reasons, I'm not going to. And she stayed at home for pretty much a year. And then she said, okay, then the following year, I've made the decision. It's going to be hard, but I'm going to. And Gary Kisik, her now fiance, did come for big chunks of it. But she said, I'm going to leave home for, say, 8 months, and I'm going to get it. I don't know. She just, I believe what she says. You know, I believe when she says something, it is going to happen, because she is very firm and she is very definitive in what she is going to do. And I don't see, as I say, I feel I see a return for her in tennis. I don't know in what capacity. I mean, she has so much to give. She's already been an inspiration to so many people. But she doesn't want to do the travelling. And a big part of tennis is doing the travelling, whether you are coaching, whether you are playing, whether you are commentating. Although, due to the pandemic, there might be slightly less of that if you're working on a commentary side of things. And she says she wants to chase other dreams. I think it's going to be really interesting. Look, she's got the world at her feet. We know whatever sport, if she wants to take up a sport, she will achieve it. Financially, she is secure for life. She inspires so many people. I'm just going to be really interested to see what the dream... Maybe the dream is she's chasing is a family. Maybe it's settling down and having a family and being at home. But I think I used the word, I was asked about it on the day it happened. I think I used the word gutted, because Barty's a strange one. When she's quite a tricky one to interview, because I always feel she's like a politician. You know, she's not going to give you breaking news. Not that we give people breaking news on the pod, but she's not going to give you breaking news. She's not going to give you, she hits a straight bat whole time. And you can sit there going, give me something. So from that point of view, you know, she wasn't going to set the world like what she said. She's very sensible. She had a job to do. But from a tennis point of view, I'm just going to miss, as you said, her style of play. I'm just going to miss her. She's just lovely. And she's going to be a massive miss. But you know what? If she has to hand the world number one over to anyone, I think that Iga Świątek is a pretty good person to hand it over to.
Yeah, I mean, it's been really cool, hasn't it? Especially because she's in such good form at the moment.
Oh, wow.
So she's playing ridiculously, of course, winning Indian Wells, and yeah, thoroughly deserved with how she's playing. And it just opens up the top of the game once again, just as we thought we were going to get somebody who was going to moderately dominate. And I don't mean dominate as in win every slam, but, you know, it just felt like at the Australian Open, she was easily the best player there. And you know, she's won all three slams. She can play on all the surfaces. Yeah, US Open, we heard from Craig Tizer as to why that was never really going to work out that well for her. It's far too quick and very much suits a particular game style, and it's not hers. But yeah, just as we thought we were going to have a little bit of stability at the top, I don't think so now.
Do you not? Because I could see Świątek dominate. I mean, she's what, won 14 matches in a row now. I think you actually picked her, didn't you? Talking of predictions, mine are terrible. to do the Sunshine Double, but she's locked in. She's playing with such freedom. I remember you speaking last week on the pod about her movement, the movement of Świątek. But she's playing with such freedom. The way she's swinging into the ball, the way she's hitting it. And I know that comes with confidence, and she's on this run of wins. But she's so young. She got the world at her feet. She can play across the surfaces. I mean, what's to say that Świątek is now not going to dominate at the top of the game?
Well, and I like your point of view, and it's great that you're right. She is swinging really freely, and she does feel very confident. But confidence and swinging freely doesn't win you Grand Slams. It does, well, it might win you one, but it does not win you multiple. It doesn't make you like an Ash Barty where you are just relentlessly at the top, number one. You think about Ash being number one, Djokovic at number one. I know that it's just switched a little bit recently because Medvedev finally got to number one for a few weeks. Looks like he's going to get back there as well again. But to be there consistently, it's really about the discipline. It's not about, I wouldn't describe Medvedev as swinging freely as he got to his number one. I wouldn't describe Djokovic as swinging freely with every Grand Slam that he wins. And the same for Ash Barty. I don't think she was swinging freely. I think that she was just executing to a level that is just so ridiculous without flinching. And the challenge is just so great for people. And they can do it on occasion, but it's so tough for people to live with that sort of level. So I love what Świątek's doing. She is on a massive run of confidence. She might pick up a slam with that confidence. She could win French Open again for the second time. She's always going to be in the mix now. But she needs to take this confidence, this swinging freely, and then work out a way to make it sustainable. That is a very, very difficult thing to do, as we've seen for lots of players. You know, even Osaka, okay, she's got four Grand Slams, so she worked out a formula for the Slams, but it's not like she picked up loads and loads of titles. We've seen Muguruza playing incredibly well at times. She's won Slams, but again, very few titles consistently. So, yeah, to me, that's not somebody who is going to dominate. And we got Ash at a point where we were thinking, I mean, this game just isn't going anywhere. She doesn't ever play, not even badly, but she doesn't even play like sort of below her ridiculously high standards. It was just, you just knew what you were going to get every single match. And, you know, that's sort of similar with Djokovic. He does sometimes drop down a level, but it's rare. And as I say, with Medvedev, it's about work and the demand of your opponents. Been watching Medvedev a lot this week in Miami. He's still going strong and he's had a tough draw. You know, he's had Andy Murray in the opening match. He's had Jensen Brooksby in his fourth round. And he shut everybody down in straights. I mean, Andy said after his match, he's like, I don't think I did much wrong. He didn't even get a break point. This is Andy Murray. Andy Murray, I don't think he's ever played a match without getting a break point. It's absolute madness. And to be honest, in all three matches, I wouldn't even say that Medvedev has been playing that well. It's not like, oh, he's playing a great match here. He is just so professional and executing and just completely destroying the souls of his opponent. Because Andy sort of fell away in the second set, and that is unusual for Andy to do. Brooksby, a great, massive part of the first set. He was a breakup. He was doing lots of really good things. Then he lost that first set and mentally he was just gone. He played, I think, about four games. He was just rolling the ball in and then just missing. And he went, you know, quickly down in the second set, I think 3-love down. And I mean, that was it. You can't do that against Medvedev. You can't do that against anyone in the top 10. But just, it's amazing to see that sort of the level of execution. It's bonkers and it's so intimidating for people.
Now, I feel I keep wanting to lavish praise on Świątek, but then you brought up Jensen Brooksby.
Yes.
And you talked at the start about Kyrgios and all sorts of bother that he got himself into against Sinner. Although Sinner would drive me bonkers because he doesn't give you anything. You could do whatever you want down the other end of the court. Sinner is going to keep that poker face, no expression. You can't annoy him. He can annoy himself. You can. Oh, for someone like Kyrgios, Sinner is not a good person to play because you're not going to get under his skin. He's just going to look at you in that very deadpan way and that's all you're going to get.
It was part of the reason why Kyrgios had a bit of a meltdown. Even within the first couple of games, we just knew it's like this is the sort of player that Kyrgios go off on one. And now Sinner has a lot of the qualities that a number one in the world would have. Probably the only exception to the rule would, of what I've been describing when it comes to people who dominate, would be Roger Federer, because his game style isn't that of somebody who can just execute over and over again with a single-handed backhand, so aggressive. But he got it, he demanded it, he got it to a point where it was so reliable that it was absurd. And you just knew what he was going to do, like on the point, he's going to serve out wide and he's going to put the first forehand volley into the corner, he's going to win this point. And then he would do it and you're like, yeah. And then the next point, like, he's going to do that again. it's just whatever the situation. So that's probably one exception, just because his game style is that little bit more flamboyant and it is a bit more free.
Yeah.
So to have that reliability when you are playing so loosely is just completely ridiculous. And no, I think to this day, no one really knows how he does it, especially with those contact points. I mean, you can see how beneficial having the contact points so far in front are, but not a single player, apart from Dimitrov, he tried, but not a single player in, you know, we've had a long time growing up, you know, all these youngsters, Brooksby, Korda, Alcaraz, they've all grown up watching Nadal and Federer, and no one's gone down the Fed route of let's take the ball this far in front, because when you try it, you go, well, that's nonsense, can't do that. That's so hard to do. But anyway, so that's probably the one exception. But Sinner does have those sort of Djokovic-like qualities, the level of discipline that he has, and he had to have it to the max against Kyrgios, and he just shut him down. I mean, talk about being a wall. He was just sort of sapped of all emotion, Sinner. And
it's
he never really gives
it?
Much emotion, but no, he was properly no. just stoic. It was like he was a statue, and he played brilliantly, of course. We expected that. But he did not give Nick anything. I didn't think he even looked at Nick through the match. He just...
Well, it's like red rag to a bull, isn't it, for Kyrgios? Because Kyrgios is like, come on then, let's get involved. And Sinner's like, no. No, yeah. I'm giving you nothing. I'm giving yeah. you
so then
massive
he had to
balls,
turn on. He had to turn on the umpire then, didn't he? And, you know, he got a point penalty, got a game penalty, which was ultimately, well, it was the ultimate self-sabotage, because he got the game penalty and he knew he was going to get the game penalty by his actions. The game penalty was his own service game at the beginning of the second set. So he started off the second set a breakdown. So, you know, that was it to make it impossible. And it was just up to Sinner to shut him out of service games, which he did.
So where do we sit with all this? It started recently with Zverev getting a suspended fine and suspension for crushing his racket against the umpire's chair. Then there was Kyrgios, who threw his racket in Indian Wells, and there was a big photo op of him meeting the ball boy and handing a racket, and you're right, mate, lovely. And then we had the Brooksby incident in Miami, and again we had the photo shot of, oh, are you okay afterwards, and lovely. And I'm sure he was very sorry, and he looked very sorry, and he looked very upset, and then obviously Kyrgios and his antics against Sinner. But I'm coming back to actions and consequences. I just don't get it. If we were in the commentary box together, and I mean, I hope you wouldn't do this, but you suddenly threw your microphone across the commentary box, you would expect there to be consequences, right? I mean, if you said something out of turn, you would expect there to be consequences. So I just don't, even if you threw your mic and then there's a little photo of you and I smiling and I've got, I don't know, a big lump on my head or something. I'm a little bit confused as to why things aren't being cracked down on. I sound like this disciplinarian. And as I said to you before, I am not with my kids. I am the soft touch. If they want to watch TV, they come to me. They don't go to their dad, because dad will say no and I will say yes, and I'll probably give them a snack to go with it. So it's completely in contrast to my character. I'm just really confused at seeing all these incidents. And it's your workplace. You cannot, in your workplace, you cannot, excuse me, as frustrated as you get in your workplace, you cannot act like they are acting. I don't know. I mean, where are you on this?
Well, I don't think it's a tennis problem. I think that this is something that happens in all areas of life. And, you know, you work...
And there are consequences.
No,
in other areas
come
of life.
On. You work in football, and they get in the ref's face so much. They're effing and blinding, and they're intimidating. Sometimes I'm watching it, and the ref is literally just walking backwards to walk away from these people who are just, and these players just right in front of their face. There's no consequences.
But if they pushed, they put their hands on the ref, or they touched him, it would be an immediate red card, and there'd probably be a longer ban after that. Brooksby,
sure.
For instance, lobbing a racket. There was nothing. There was a photo up afterwards, patting the shoulder of him. Are you? And I'm sure the guy was really, really sorry. But there have to be some form of consequence. There has to be some form of, you can't do that.
Well, yeah, but then tennis was in the news again with the film King Richard, and I don't think it was to do with the fact that Will Smith won the Oscar. He just stood up, he was in the audience, stood up, slapped him in the face, and then just sat back down.
Yeah, and there's talk.
I understand.
No, but there's talk that he might be stripped of his Oscar. It might or might not happen.
Talk,
I mean,
exactly.
No, but there's not even talk in the situations we're talking about of things happening. It's happened. There was a photo. A racket was handed over, and we move on to the next tournament.
In tennis, there are very clear rules. So, if you want to change the rules, that's absolutely fine, and we can have a conversation about it. But the rules are very clear. If you harm somebody, whether it's deliberate or an accident, I mean, if it's deliberate, that is obviously assault, so police could get involved.
yeah, I hope so.
Which was always the thing after Djokovic got defaulted. People defending him, going, we didn't do it deliberately. It's like, well, what? If he had deliberately injured her, then, as I say, that would be assault. She could phone the police. Like, this is absurd to think that he only got kicked out of a match. He didn't get arrested.
I mean, this is a grey area because Zverev deliberately went to crunch the chair near the chair umpire.
No, he didn't. If he had wanted to hurt the chair umpire, he would have hurt the chair umpire. I know he wasn't far off, but he was deliberately not far off. Look, the rule is if you cause an injury through reckless behaviour, then that's it. That's the default. And that's what we saw with Djokovic. He caused an injury through his reckless behaviour. If he had teed that ball and it had missed the linesperson by 6 inches, it's nothing. I don't think that would even be a code violation. It's sort of at the discretion of the chair umpire, but if it stayed within the grounds, it's a code violation. So the rule is so with your racket, like we saw with Brooksby, or with a ball, like I think we saw from Aliash Bedenay, that was ages ago though, to be honest. If you hit somebody accidentally through reckless behaviour, but they're absolutely fine, like, you know, the racket from Brooksby just sort of nudged the foot of the ball person, then that's a code violation. It's an unsportsmanlike conduct. It's a warning. If you get another one, you lose a point. So there are consequences for it. It's not a nothing warning, like a time violation is a bit of a nothing warning, really. You're getting a warning because you're being told you're running the risk of injuring somebody. You can't do that. If you do injure somebody, your match is done, your tournament is done, and you're kicked out. I personally don't disagree with those rules. Now, I understand that I absolutely feel like you're sharing the court as a player with other professionals. You're not there on your own. You do get wrapped up in your own thoughts. The cameras are all on you. They're not on these other people. But if you think about the amount of people on the court, especially when we had lines judges, you've got, what, 6 ball kids. You're going to have at least 5 lines judges. So we're already at, what, 11? You've got the chair umpire. You've also got camera operators that are along. They're actually on the court. You know, so you're sharing your court. You've got your opponent as well. So you're looking at like 14 people that you are on the court with. So, yeah, I would love to see the players be more considerate towards the other professionals that they are sharing the court with. But, you know, sport... It is going to get heated, and I do think they should follow Andy Roddick's rules of slamming the racket and the ball into the ground near them. And I've always felt this, just like, why are you doing that? I mean, one that we do sort of see is them tee it into the sky, and there was just that one horrendous incident with Shapovalov where, I mean, can you imagine of all of the space for him to hit it into? I mean, what a disaster that was. The warnings are there to deter people from doing things that are reckless and to encourage them to take their frustrations out more like Andy Murray. Oh, sorry, not Andy Murray. More like Andy Roddick was suggesting, in their own sort of area, and make sure that the way they're venting their frustrations is not reckless. But as the rules are written, I don't disagree with them. You know, I don't think that Brooksby should get defaulted for flinging his racket along the ground and it ending up hitting the ball kid's foot.
I think if not defaulted, I think an immediate point. I think you lose. I don't warn someone not to do something that you shouldn't do. I think there's certain things, yes, coach, you can get a warning, but when it comes to something like that, I'm not saying default for what he did, but I think he should be docked a point. I don't warn someone not to throw your racket when you shouldn't be throwing it in the first place. Do you see what I mean? I understand coaching, there's a warning and a few other things you can give a warning before you then take action in terms of points. I'm not saying he should have been defaulted, but I think if you'd said, right, immediately that's a point, Would you agree with that? Just because it's something he shouldn't be doing in the first place, and that would nip it in the bud 100%. It's not a warning. That's a point. Done.
Yeah, I think possibly. I think possibly there could also just be some more work done post-match in terms of speaking to him and saying, look, you know, this isn't acceptable. And next time we've put a mark next to your name, and you are somebody that you're forfeiting your warnings. And you are just going to go now straight to a point because you've done it a number of times.
Yeah.
You're not following the rules. And, you know, I'm sorry, but, you know, you might not think it's anything, but we've got people to look after on the court. And if you do it, you will go straight to a point. I don't understand why that can't be a thing. Like just a little black mark. And you say, you know, until you've had 6 months of good behaviour, you can't come back. So, you know, I suppose I can generally agree that it all feels a little bit lenient that we just get an apology, a warning on the court and an apology. I wouldn't advocate for going in, you know, significantly stronger. Look, Zverev got defaulted. He was kicked out of the tournament for his actions. That was appropriate. Djokovic's actions were entirely accidental, but he caused significant injury and he was defaulted. And I think that is absolutely correct. So it's difficult. The rules are being applied correctly. They are not being applied wrongly in any of these situations. With the Brooksby one, I think it was Carlos Bernardes in the chair and he was playing against Correa. And Correa was saying, isn't he getting defaulted? We remember the Naomi Brody and Ostapenko situation way back when. I mean, that was awesome with Brody saying that she should get defaulted and getting very wound up about it. Correa also got very wound up about it, saying that he should be getting more than this. You can't do that. So I think that, I mean, it's difficult. There's definitely room for it to be a little bit stricter, but I wouldn't be leaping. I wouldn't be leaping away from it.
Talking about controlled aggression and discipline for one of the twins, they've got their grading this week in their Little Samurai. Now this is to get their first belt. So this is big stuff. So this is obviously because we wanted them to do it because it's like, you know, self-defense and stuff. It's all very controlled. They're not allowed to do all the kicks outside of the class. But yes, a Little Samurai grading for their, I want to get this right. I think it's for the red belt. I think I've got that right. I don't know. So that's a big thing this week. So that's all about controlled aggression, doing it in the class, and don't bring those kind of roundhouse, swivel house kick things outside. So I will keep you posted. I'll keep you posted with how the grading goes. Something else that came up this week, my words came back to haunt me when I said I don't know why I'm picking Tsitsipas to win Miami because he faces Carlos Alcaraz early on. Yes, and he lost him. But earlier in the tournament, Tsitsipas saying, hey, women, best of five sets at Grand Slam. There's equal prize money. So let's have five sets. What do you think?
You're boring. Not you. That was aimed at Stefanos. I just don't understand the desire for it. Like, I just don't. I don't get it. I understand that you can get some epic best of five set matches. I don't agree with, but I understand the argument for reducing the men's best of five in the first week of a slam to three and then increasing the best of five for the women in week two. So everybody plays three sets in week one and everybody plays five sets in week two. It's not what I think, but I can see that point of view. Like, if that's what you think or if that's what somebody else thinks, cool. I personally think that it is about the appropriate length of time. And I think that the appropriate length of time to get the best quality matches for the women is best of three sets. I also think that largely that's an appropriate time for the men because they do that for the vast majority of the year. They used to play best of five sets at the end of Masters and they scrapped it because it was so physical and they had to turn around quickly for maybe it was back-to-back Masters like Indian Wells and Miami. Maybe it was, you know, just getting to another tournament or it was before a slam or, you know, whatever the case was. It didn't work. So they scrapped it a long time ago and went to best of three. And I think that's contributing to the younger players struggling, like Zverev struggling in the best of five format in the slams, because he'd won multiple Masters events,
but he's
never had to play the best of five. Whereas Djokovic, when he first started winning Masters events, had to play best of five in the finals. So you get those more opportunities to play the best of five against the very, very best, because you're in the final of a Masters event. I just think that it's the appropriate amount of time. I think that we get epic women's matches. I think that they are incredible matches. And even if, you buy a ticket to the Wimbledon final and it's an hour and a half for women's matches, well, a football game's an hour and a half. You know, a rugby match, like, an hour and a half is an appropriate amount of time for a sporting event to last. I don't understand the need for it to be 5 hours. No one wants that.
I tell you where else you can have an epic hour and a half. That is in padel. The world of padel, which is a world I'm involved in currently.
Yes.
I'm working on the Premier Padel Tournament. It's the Qatar Major. Padel, is it a sport you've ever played?
It's not, no. I've never tried. I've seen quite a lot of it live, just at clubs, watching people play. It looks really fun.
It's heavily based in tennis, played in a cage, so it's got a twist of squash. So it's the same scoring system as tennis, the same shot selections. The two big differences are you're playing in a cage, so you can hit the ball off the perspex cage around you, and the serve is really to start the point. It's underarm, you hit it, you bounce it, you hit it around waist height. It's largely played in doubles, and it's largely played in, I mean, Spain is the capital of padel. Players, if they want to turn professional and be the very, very best, they go to Spain. This tournament at the moment, I think yesterday, for them 64 odd players on court, there were 48 were Spanish. And then you're following with Argentina. Wow. And then you've got Brazil in there. There's a handful of French, Italian. I think in Italy, there was a large jump in it during COVID. I mean, 25 million people worldwide play the sport of padel now. They use tennis balls. They're slightly less pressure than the tennis ball that you would use. I've really immersed myself in the last week. And it's best of three sets. The three tiebreak sets, exactly the same scoring. But it's a point can last 11 minutes. There's a point this week that lasted 11 minutes.
It's just insane.
One point. 11
that's
minutes.
Just mad. Wait, how long does a match last?
Well, I had the extremes yesterday, because yesterday the top eight pairings had a bye in the first round, so it was a little bit lopsided, because I think the third seeds were playing the 57th best pair in the world, and it lasted 46 minutes. Because it's really quick. It's, you know, the unknown serve, bang, bang, start again. There's no real hanging around discussion. Where are you going to stand? What are you going to do? What's going to happen? They know what they're going to do. They're going to get the ball in play, get the point going, and off we go. So it's really quick. But they change, the balls change after 9-11 games, and they have the same changeovers as in tennis. But it's really quick. And the other thing, from a commentary point of view, we've spent our whole life with TV tennis commentary being told, don't talk during the point, do not talk during the point. But in padel, you do. Because you've got an 11-minute point, you have to talk.
There's no other time. Well, from the sounds of it, there's no time between points.
Not really.
You don't have your 25 seconds.
No.
So if you don't talk during the point, you're not going to talk.
It's even quite hard doing...
That'd be an easy gig, wouldn't it? Just sit and watch some padel for a bit.
It's even quite hard doing like camera replays. Because the chances are the point's already underway and it may even have been finished once you've got your replay away. So it's...
Wow. It's totally different rhythm.
It's,
I will just say,
yes,
out of note, is that, you know, padel is a very new sport. It's been going for a few years, but it's a new sport. Professionally, it's a new sport. Am I correct? I don't want to make statements that are awfully wrong.
Ish.
In comparison to tennis,
there's hundreds
of years old.
Sorry, yes. Right? In comparison to tennis,
and other sports.
Of course,
well,
yes.
I mean, it's a modern sport.
Yes.
It is a modern sport, a modern creation. And they, I know it's a bit of a callback, but they have decided to go with best of three sets, not best of five sets.
Yes, they have.
Just saying.
But you're looking at about, say, an hour and a half for a match. I mean, you can have a three-hour match. Of course you can, because you've got three tie-break sets. But
like tennis.
But I did a match yesterday that was 46 minutes long, and it was done, you're like, oh, right, it's over. And then you're probably looking at a standard around an hour and 20. But we're gonna play, because I've never played.
We're going to play.
You've never played. You're still going to be a million times better than me. I'll have all the... I'll have the words. I'll have the vocab. I'll talk a really good paddle match, but you will play a very good paddle match. So
you wildly overestimate me, because the slight issue I have, and the reason I've not played paddle to this point is you have walls, you have a cage, and I was very much sort of the player that just decided to thump the ball away for a winner, and it's going to be very annoying when it comes back.
Well, the downside for you is that it's got to hit the court before it hits the wall. So if you let rip like you would do with a forehand, and it just hits the ball and comes back, you lose the point. But if you manage to use your power to hit the court wall and back over your side, you win the point. So this could be a new career.
You can give me a coaching session.
Okay, so I'm going to be your coach. We're going to head down to the paddle court. And this is going to be good. Right, I've got to go now and talk about paddle. You have to talk about tennis. And
Miami quarterfinals.
Can we just, and I've got the paddle round of 16. And can I just apologise in advance for the breaking news that we have missed this week? And we will cover it. We will cover it in next week's pod.
We should have a segment that's called Week Old Feature, Week Old News. We'll do Week Old News.
I think that's our pod, isn't it? I think that's the pod.
Stale.
Bye.